All right. Well, let's turn in our Bibles to Job chapter 29. As was mentioned earlier, we don't have a Bible study the next two Sundays. And with Christmas kind of upon us, I'm going to say something that might be a little unorthodox, maybe somewhat controversial, but maybe if you're a little strapped for cash as you've been having these extra expenses during the Christmas season, or maybe if you are looking to get a special gift for someone and you need a little extra money, you might want to, I don't know, take advantage of a little wager this morning. I'm going to try to teach through three chapters. So I don't know what the odds are on that, of getting through it, but I've already heard Shane's sermon isn't all that great, so we're just going to stay in here. I mean, before he even started, the rumblings were already getting out of the sanctuary, so. All right, you can start the recording now. So as we come to this section, as we have been really on this downhill slope, I guess you'd say, of Job's final remarks, maybe not the final things he will say, but his final lengthy statements pertaining to his travail and his trying to understand what is happening in his own life, we come to this section in chapters 29 through 31, and it is basically a summation. This is Job, in a sense, summarizing the entire journey, summarizing his whole difficulty, his whole perspective, in a very sweeping kind of way. When you think about the broader sweep of the narrative that we've found ourselves in as we've kind of journeyed with Job and these three friends that came along to provide what ended up being unhelpful and even provocative and hurtful counsel and rebuke to Job. We've seen Job sort of lament and go up and down with emotion and respond to his friends with elements of frustration and even potential righteous indignation. We've seen him at very weak moments. We've heard him make statements that would be an indication of a profound, deep faith and confidence in the Lord in spite of all of his confusion and all of his turmoil and all of his pain and suffering. If you go back to the very beginning of this incredible narrative and think about the testimony about Job, you can begin in chapter 1, verse 1, with the narrator or the writer of Job saying this: "There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was blameless and upright, one who feared God and turned away from evil." This very succinct statement about this man Job, who would then become the primary subject of this entire lengthy narrative, was characterized in these profound, comprehensive terms of integrity, of righteousness, and of faithfulness and adoration for his God. Then you have the Lord's testimony. I mean, if that wasn't enough to give us an indication of who this man Job was, you have the Lord's testimony in that amazing scene in heaven where the sons of God come before the Lord and Satan finds his way into the Lord's presence. And the Lord God himself in verse 8 of chapter 1 says this to Satan. He says, "Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil?" Imagine such a testimony. This is from the God of the universe, who knows the thoughts and intentions and actions and movements of everyone all the time. So when it comes to accurate or precise survey data, there is no rival. And so when God himself renders this kind of judgment about this man, it is comprehensively true. It is an accurate description of this man. And then he extends this even further in the second encounter with Satan. When Satan comes before him again after an initial round of trials that he levels against Job by permission of God himself. And God says this to Satan again, "Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth? A blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil. He still holds fast his integrity, although you incited me against him to destroy him without reason." This is the Lord God himself doubling down in his affirmation of the unflinching integrity and blamelessness and righteousness of this man, Job. So from the jump, we have this incredible man who is bolstered by this incredible testimony of the narrator that again is affirmed and even more specifically expanded by God himself. And then along come his friends. Let's think about the summation of his friends' testimonies about him. You have Eliphaz in the third speech in Job chapter 22, where in that section he directly fabricates specific sins that Job had presumably perpetrated against the poor and the vulnerable, if you recall that discussion. Eliphaz levels these false accusations of Job in very harsh ways in an effort to contradict Job's cries of innocence. He says this about Job: "Is not your evil abundant? There is no end to your iniquities, for you have exacted pledges of your brothers for nothing and stripped the naked of their clothing. You have given no water to the weary to drink, and you have withheld bread from the hungry. The man with power possessed the land, and the favored man lived in it. You have sent widows away empty, and the arms of the fatherless were crushed." I mean, he couldn't have given a more profound litany of the vulnerable that Job has in his estimation, in Eliphaz's estimation, been very cruel to, all of which was made up. Then you have Bildad actually speaking of the justified death of his children. This is a man, Job, who lost his children as part of this trial that was undertaken really at the behest of God himself, but executed by Satan. And part of that included his children dying, being taken from him. And Bildad comes along in Job chapter 8 and says, "If your children have sinned against him, he has delivered them into the hand of their transgression. If you will seek God and plead with the Almighty for mercy, if you are pure and upright, surely then he will rouse himself for you and restore your rightful habitation." A man who is writhing in physical pain and suffering under the emotional torment of the loss that he's experienced, in particular, the loss of his children, and Bildad comes along and says, "It's probably because they sinned and they got what they deserved. Now you just need to repent, Job." And then Zophar comes along in his blunt and condemning way and basically claims that Job's punishment is actually merciful compared to what he should get. In Job chapter 11, Zophar says, "But oh, that God would speak and open his lips to you, and that he would tell you the secrets of wisdom, for he is manifold in understanding. Know then that God exacts of you less than your guilt deserves." So again, these three men, their testimony of Job couldn't be farther from the testimony of the actual narrator who sets up the whole backdrop of the the story of Job, and then God's testimony two separate times before all the hosts of heaven directly to the adversary. When you come to this final section beginning in Job chapter 29, we get to hear Job's testimony. How would Job describe this uprightness? How would Job characterize this blamelessness? What does Job, as a man who truly fears the Lord, what has his life been like? And what we'll see is that Job goes into great detail in helping us see a fuller picture of his life, both past and present, and what he's crying out for in the future. Derek Kidner, sort of commenting on this whole section, says, "The deeper Job's darkness, the more his grip tightens on what he has always stood for, and the more doggedly he gropes for the way home." We're going to get a very broad and sweeping and somewhat detailed picture of this man Job as he summarizes the entire journey that he's been on, both in terms of the trials and the suffering that he's been experiencing, but also the opinions and testimony, false testimony of these three men against him. So what we're going to do is we're going to read each chapter kind of in succession as we deal with each particular point. Each chapter has its own point and an outline. And we'll begin in chapter 29, which really, you can just summarize chapter 29 as Job's nostalgic longing for the previous heights of blessing and righteousness. There is Job looking back nostalgically at his life before these trials began, and this is what we see in chapter 29. So let's pick up the text in verse 1. It says, "And Job again took up his discourse and said, 'Oh, that I were as in the months of old, as in the days when God watched over me, when his lamp shone upon my head, and by his light I walked through darkness, as I was in my prime, when the friendship of God was upon my tent, when the Almighty was yet with me, when my children were all around me, when my steps were washed with butter and the rock poured out for me streams of oil. When I went out to the gate of the city, when I prepared my seat in the square, the young men saw me and withdrew, and the aged rose and stood. The princes refrained from talking and laid their hand on their mouth. The voice of the nobles was hushed, and their tongue stuck to the roof of their mouth. When the ear heard, it called me blessed, and when the eye saw, it approved. Because I delivered the poor who cried for help, and the fatherless who had none to help him. The blessing of him who was about to perish came upon me, and I caused the widow's heart to sing for joy. I put on righteousness, and it clothed me. My justice was like a robe and a turban. I was eyes to the blind and feet to the lame. I was a father to the needy, and I searched out the cause of him who I did not know. I broke the fangs of the unrighteous and made him drop his prey from his teeth. Then I thought, I shall die in my nest, and I shall multiply my days as the sand. My roots spread out to the waters with the dew all night on my branches. My glory fresh with me and my bow ever new in my hand. Men listened to me and waited and kept silence for my counsel. After I spoke, they did not speak again, and my word dropped upon them. They waited for me as for the rain, and they opened their mouths as for the spring rain. I smiled on them when they had no confidence, and the light of my face they did not cast down. I chose their way and sat as a chief, and I lived like a king among his troops, like one who comforts mourners." This is Job recounting his life prior to these sufferings befalling him. He's looking back certainly with a certain nostalgic longing, a certain wishful thinking that he could be back in those times or that those days would return. But let's take note of a few of the characteristics of Job's life more fully sort of articulated by Job himself in this chapter that we only had a certain sense of or a certain inkling of, or we had to kind of fill in the gaps for ourselves by virtue of the testimony of the narrator of Job in chapter 1 and of God himself in chapters 1 and 2. Notice first that Job, and this is something that we've discussed on a, on repeated occasions, and it played out in Job's responses to his three friends on a several different occasions. But Job enjoyed, and what he describes here is that he enjoyed the unmatched blessing of God's protection, God's friendship, and God's presence. And that's what he's longing for. That's the first thing on his list. You may recall us on several different occasions making the point that Job, yes, was suffering under the trial of loss of his family and of his possessions and of his reputation. And he was struggling profoundly with the pain and agony of his physical suffering. But what Job indicated time and time again, that what gripped his soul and what churned him on the inside was what seemed as though the absence of the God with whom he had such rich and close fellowship previously. And here's the testimony of that in chapter 29 by Job himself. In verses 2 and 3, the second part of verse 2, he says, "The days when God watched over me, when his lamp shone upon my head, and by his light I walked through darkness." This picture of God's protection and God's presence with him in even in dark places. This kind of has echoes of Psalm 23 and the shepherding care of the Lord who provides for him. And even though you walk through the valley of the shadow of death, you fear no evil because the Lord is with you. It has these sort of echoes of that kind of understanding of God's protection and his friendship and his presence in verses 4 and 5. When the friendship, this is a term for intimate confidant. Intimate confidence that was shared between him and the Lord. So what he's painting a picture of here is not just sort of theoretical, that Job is describing a fellowship that he shared with the Lord that had an intimacy with it, the kind of intimacy that is shared between two people who have the most unquestioned trust in one another, willing to share the most strictest and private confidences between one another. This is the kind of friendship that he is describing here, when the friendship of God was upon me and when the Almighty was yet with me. This is what he's longing for. This is what he is nostalgic for. This is what he's looking back and recognizing has been lost in his current state. This is an amazing testimony of a man who is suffering under what feels like the complete absence of the God who was once so incredibly near. And we've talked about this on numerous occasions. Many of you, if not all of you, could testify to the fact that even in spite of our convictions about God's goodness and faithfulness, and even in spite of maybe long periods of life and testimony in which we just proclaim the goodness and mercy and provision of God and his faithfulness and our sense of his nearness and presence, we can go through a dark time and we have to confess that God himself, who loves us, who saved us, who is everywhere at all times, and who executes his will and purpose for us with perfection, seems completely absent. Like we go through these dark times, and it's as though the God of the universe, who we adore and worship and serve and rely upon and trust, is now not even existent anymore. And Job, what Job is expressing is this battle between the sense of God's complete and utter absence, but a heart that is longing for his presence once again. It is an example to us that the cry of our hearts when God seems far away is a cry of longing for his fellowship once again. He doesn't begin with a cry for a deliverance from the suffering. He is crying out or longing for a restoration of God's friendship. Charles Spurgeon says there is everywhere in the expressions Job uses such a strain of spirituality that we are inclined to believe he had more reference to the condition of his heart than to the state of his property. He was more interested in that fellowship, that spiritual vitality and fellowship, than he was the loss of possessions. And you see this longing for this blessing of God and his protection and friendship and presence. And then you notice, you see here that he once had a profound joy that was rooted in a communal affirmation and honor, like an unparalleled affirmation and honor that he received and was the beneficiary of from those in his community. It begins with this immensely bountiful home and family life. When my children, he says in verse 5, when my children were all around me, when my steps were washed with butter and the rock poured out for me streams of oil. Now, I don't recommend washing your steps with butter. That might seem a little bit risky. It's hard to say, well, that, why is that an indication of a bountiful home and family life? It is an indication of that. It's speaking to the fact that there was so much provision in his life that he could actually use butter to wash his steps with it. And in other words, this rare delicacy of food, this provision of food was so abundant that he could use it as just cleaning material for his front steps. The same kind of idea. And the rock poured out for me streams of olive oil. It just, the provision and blessing, the bounty of the Lord was just bursting forth in such a way that what was so special and so needed and such an essential part of people's sustenance was so abundant for him that it could become common cleaning material. And everyone knows the bounty that can be experienced, the affirmation that can be experienced when a family is rich and full and there is fellowship and shared love and affection and there's common worship. Many know the heartbreak when that is not the case. It is a heartbreaking matter when families are broken. And Job is speaking to this time when he was experiencing the most comprehensive richness and bounty of home and family life. And he had this revered public reputation. Unparalleled honor and respect was shown to him. You see this in verses 7 through 11. When I went out to the gate of the city, when I prepared my seat in the square, the young men saw me and withdrew, and the aged rose and stood. These are indications of honor and respect by both the young and the old. This is an amazing testimony that it didn't matter who it was. It would be somewhat understandable for the young to do this, for the young to demonstrate by their physical response when you walk among them that they back away, they step aside. But he's saying that it's the young and the old who demonstrate a level of honor and respect when he walks among them in the city gate. This image of sort of the communal area where business and commerce and government and community affairs took place. And when he came among them, there was a distinctive respect and honor that was demonstrated. The princes, those with high status and place in the community, refrained from talking and laid their hand on their mouth. This poetic language to demonstrate that Job's here. Even the princes, even the ones who would opine and who would render judgments and who had the authority and the status to be able to speak what they wanted to, when they wanted to, when Job was among them, even they spoke not, is the indication here. The voice of the nobles was hushed and their tongue stuck to the roof of their mouth. When the ear heard, it called me blessed, and when the eye saw, it approved. This is just poetic language describing this place of unparalleled honor that Job had in the community. That people of every age and every strata of life and rank in society, when Job was around, he was the man of ultimate and supreme honor. And then you notice as well the character of this man. He was known as a generous and a just and even a courageous servant of people. You see this in verses 12 to 17. He says, because I delivered the poor who cried for help and the fatherless who had none to help him. The blessing of him who was about to perish came upon me, and I caused the widow's heart to sing for joy. I mean, he's basically directly refuting the slanderous lies that Eliphaz spoke about him when he recounted all these phony sins that Job was guilty of and all of his oppressive acts toward the most vulnerable in society. Job's testimony which is only the details of what the writer of Job and God himself have already affirmed, Job's testimony is a detailed description of the exact opposite of what Eliphaz said. That he, though was a man of prestige and honor amongst the most noble of society, was a humble, generous servant of the lowliest and the most vulnerable among them. Verse 14, I put on righteousness and it clothed me. My justice was like a robe and a turban. I was eyes to the blind and feet to the lame. I was a father to the needy, and I searched out the cause of him who I did not know. I broke the fangs of the unrighteous and made him drop his prey from his teeth. This is an indication of Job's courage. It wasn't just that he sought those kinds of service opportunities to help those that were most vulnerable and maybe seek some kind of, you know, recompense and praise and adoration for him being so kind and generous to the most vulnerable. This is an indication that he would step into situations in which there was someone who was fierce, someone who was threatening, someone who was dangerous, who was bringing harm to someone who was vulnerable. And he gives you this language of fangs, that someone is actually in the grip and the teeth of some kind of onerous person. And Job would step into those situations and compel this person, this oppressive person to, he says, drop his prey from his teeth. It wasn't just that he leveraged his wealth and his resources to sort of give a little tip here and there to those in need. This was a man who was engaged in helping and serving people in ways that ultimately could be harmful to him. And then we see here that he is also a wise and encouraging counselor. You see this in verses 21 to 25. Men listened to me. They waited and kept silence for my counsel. You have this metaphor. They waited for me, verse 23, as for the rain, and they opened their mouths as for the spring rain. The writer's using poetic language, putting poetic words in Job's mouth to describe how valuable his counsel was to these men. They waited with their mouths open as though his words of wisdom and counsel were like refreshing rain that would quench their thirst for knowledge and understanding and wisdom. And this is a man of incredible reputation. He was encouraging. It says in verse 24, I smiled on them when they had no confidence. In the light of my face, they did not cast down. I chose their way and sat as chief and lived like a king among his troops, like one who comforts mourners. He saw himself in all of his prestige and power and influence as one who could actually use all of that to bring joy and comfort to people who needed that. To encourage those who were downtrodden and lacked confidence, he wanted to build them up and give them strength for whatever was before them. So when the Lord God himself says that there was none like him on the earth, that this was a blameless and upright man who feared the Lord, this is a description of what we're talking about. We're talking about a man of such faithfulness, such stewardship of what God had blessed him with, such sacrificial living and thinking that prompted him to action on behalf of others, that it garnered him a type of joy and fellowship with the Lord and friendship and communal affirmation with those that he lived among, that we should aspire to, that is an envious kind of profile that this man had. We get to chapter 30, and we are brought to the present. He's longing for that past season of fellowship with the Lord and of faithfulness and service in his community, of good reputation. And now we get to this graphic depiction of the present depths of suffering and despair that he's having to endure. And this is what we see in chapter 30. We're on the second chapter, by the way, for those of you who are counting. Let's read chapter 30 together. Again, reminding us Chapter 29 and 25, I chose their way and sat as chief, and I lived like a king among his troops, like one who comforts mourners. But now they laugh at me. Men who are younger than I, whose fathers I would have disdained to set with the dogs of my flock. What could I gain from the strength of their hands, men whose vigor is gone? Through want and hard hunger, they gnaw the dry ground by night in waste and desolation. They pick saltwort and the leaves of bushes and the roots of the broom tree for their food. They are driven out from human company. They shout after them as after a thief. In the gullies of the torrents they must dwell, in holes of the earth and of the rocks. Among the bushes they bray, under the nettles they huddle together. A senseless, a nameless brood, they have been whipped out of the land. And now I have become their song. I am a byword to them. Let me stop right there for just a second. This is Job basically describing the actual profile of the very people that he served and helped and supported and fed and encouraged and counseled. In other words, he's giving us a perspective from the standpoint of society. That these are people who would be considered the dregs of society. Utterly impoverished. He gives all this imagery of their inability to even provide sustenance for themselves. He says, and these are the ones now, the ones that I helped, the ones that I served, the ones that I provided for, the ones that I sacrificed for, these are the ones now to whom I am a byword. These are the ones that I have now become their song. In other words, he's describing basically a derision and a scorn that he is now receiving from those he previously helped. So when we think about the suffering and trial of Job, we can sort of comfortably and neatly categorize the nature of his overall travail in the categories of loss of family and loss of wealth and loss of reputation and loss of health. But here, Job is giving testimony to how much further it actually went. How deep the wounds are actually cutting. The very people that he just described helping have turned on him. These people that he himself, from the standpoint of strata in society, had to stoop down to, way down to serve, to minister to help, to feed, to nourish. Now they're the ones that are deriding him and laughing at him and mocking him and scorning him. This is an unbelievable turn. It says in verse 10, they abhor me. They keep aloof from me. They do not hesitate to spit at the sight of me. This is unreal. Not only is there derision, he uses the term that I'm now their song. It's sort of this idea of the mock and the scorn and sort of the making him a byword, making him sort of an insignificant person that they can just make fun of or tease in some way. Now it gets to this place of what you just might call an excessive communal cruelty and abasement. It's not just that they make fun of him. They act in ways toward him that are utterly and completely cruel. This is what he begins to describe in verse 10 that I just read. The abhorrence that they demonstrate. They keep aloof from him. So now you have these people who quite literally, by every societal measure, were the dregs of society. And they're standing above him now, aloof. They're standing over him now. And they're exercising a level of cruelty that is hard to fathom. Verse 11, they're aloof, but then they also don't hesitate to spit at the sight of him. They're just so disgusted by him. And then verse 11, because God has loosed my cord and humbled me, they have cast off restraint in my presence. They don't hold back at all. There's no holding back on their mocking, their ridicule, their physical acts of derision, of debasement, of cruelty. Verse 12, on my right hand, the rabble rise. They push away my feet. He's just in their way. They kick him away. They cast up against me their ways of destruction. They break up my path. They promote my calamity. They need no one to help them. As through a wide breach they come, amid the crash they roll on. He's just describing that this whole community, among whom he sat as a chief and a servant and a helper, they've all turned on him. And the level of cruelty and derision and scorn and debasement is nothing short of excessive. And then he begins to describe what we might just consider this relentless emotional and physical torment. You see this really broken in two different sections, in verses 16 to 18 and then again in verses 27 to 31. He says, "And now my soul is poured out within me. Days of affliction have taken hold of me. The night racks my bones, and the pain that gnaws me takes no rest. With great force my garment is disfigured. It binds me about like a collar of my tunic." And then down in verse 27, "My inward parts are in turmoil and never still. Days of affliction come to meet me. I go about darkened, but not by the sun. I stand up in the assembly and cry for help. I am a brother of jackals and a companion of ostriches. My skin turns black and falls from me, and my bones burn with heat. My lyre is turned to mourning, and my pipe to the voice of those who weep." This is Job. Once again, we've seen him kind of lament in these ways in previous chapters, but he's just giving more explicit voice to the degree of this relentless emotional and physical torment that he is just continuing to suffer under. And then you have this excruciating spiritual isolation and fear and despair that he's experiencing. We've already alluded to the longing that he has to have that restored fellowship with God. Look at verse 19 through 26. "God has cast me into the mire, and I become like dust and ashes. I cry to you for help, and you do not answer me. I stand, and you only look at me. You have turned cruel to me. With the might of your hand, you persecute me. You lift me up on the wind. You make me ride on it. You toss me about in the roar of the storm. For I know that you will bring me to death and to the house appointed for all living. Yet does not one in a heap of ruins stretch out his hand and in his disaster cry for help? Did I not weep for him whose day was hard? Was not my soul grieved for the needy? But when I hoped for good, evil came. And when I waited for light, darkness came." There again, as I already alluded to, this is a man who is suffering under the torment of spiritual isolation. This God that he worshiped, that he adored, and that he represented so well by his own life and testimony now seems distant and has cast him down. And he's feeling the isolation and the fear of being tossed to and fro in these trials with no relief. And he's despairing. So you go from this testimony of days past that were just an exaltation of his uprightness and his righteousness and his fear of the Lord to this present circumstance that he just continues to elaborate on. But he doesn't elaborate on it in ways that are descriptive of his losses. He elaborates on it in ways that are descriptive of his lack of ability to continue the ministry that God had given him previously in his community. And the torment that he's experiencing at the hands of those he once served, and the degree to which he is suffering under a sense of God's complete absence from his life. And then you get to chapter 31. This is Job's final appeal. This is it. In fact, at the very end of the chapter, you see him, you see the writer say at the end of verse 40, "The words of Job are ended." Chapter 31, let's just read it together. He says, "I have made a covenant with my eyes. How then could I gaze at a virgin? What would be my portion from God above and my heritage from the Almighty on high? Is not calamity for the unrighteous and disaster for the workers of iniquity? Does not he see my ways and number all my steps? If I have walked with falsehood and my foot has hastened to deceit, let me be weighed in a just balance and let God know my integrity. If my step has turned aside from the way and my heart has gone after my eyes, and if any spot has stuck to my hands, then let me sow and another eat, and let what grows for me be rooted out. If my heart has been enticed toward a woman and I have lain in wait at my neighbor's door, then let my wife grind for another and let others bow down on her. For that would be a heinous crime, and that would be an iniquity to be punished by the judges. For that would be a fire that consumes as far as Abaddon, and it would burn to the root all my increase. If I have rejected the cause of my manservant or my maidservant when they brought a complaint against me, what then shall I do when God rises up, when he makes inquiry, what shall I answer him? Did not he who made me in the womb make him, and did not one fashion us in the womb? If I have withheld anything that the poor desired, or have caused the eyes of the widow to fail, or have eaten my morsel alone, and the fatherless has not eaten of it. For from my youth the fatherless grew up with me as a father, and from my mother's womb I guided the widow. If I have seen anyone perish for lack of clothing, or the needy without covering, if his body has not blessed me, and if he was not warmed with the fleece of my sheep, if I have not raised my hand against the fatherless because I saw my help in the gate, then let my shoulder blade fall from my shoulder, and let my arm be broken from its socket. For I was in terror of calamity from God, and I could not have faced his majesty. If I have made gold my trust, or called fine gold my confidence, if I rejoiced because my wealth was abundant, or because my hand had found much, if I had looked at the sun when it shone, or the moon moving in splendor, and my heart has been secretly enticed, and my mouth has kissed my hand, this also would be an iniquity to be punished by the judges, for I would have been false to God above. If I have rejoiced at the ruin of him who hated me, or exulted when evil overtook him, I have not let my mouth sin by asking for his life with a curse. If the men of my tent have not said, "Who is there? Who has not been filled with his meat? The sojourner has not lodged in the street. I have opened my doors to the traveler. If I have concealed my transgressions as others do by hiding my iniquity in my heart, because I stood in great fear of the multitude, and the contempt of families terrified me so that I kept silence and did not go out of doors, oh, that I had one to hear me. Here is my signature. Let the Almighty answer me. Oh, that I had the indictment written by my adversary. Surely I would carry it on my shoulder. I would bind it on me as a crown. I would give him an account of all my steps. Like a prince, I would approach him. If my land has cried out against me and its furrows have wept together, if I have eaten its yield without payment and made its owners breathe their last, let thorns grow instead of wheat and foul weeds instead of barley. The words of Job are ended. This is Job's impassioned appeal for the pervasive breadth of executed justice or vindication. He wants justice or vindication. And we've seen him cry out for that over and over again. This is a unique section, though. This is what theologians call a negative confession. Job is issuing a negative confession. This is his oath of innocence or clearance of his guilt, which he declares by denying a long series of possible ethical failures or sins. If this, then let this judgment befall me. This is a man who is standing upright before God and before men and saying, if any of these things are true for me, let justice prevail. Let the punishment that is due me come. I have nothing to hide. I'm not running away. I'm not trying to deceive. The key elements that we see here in this confession are this proclamation of his actual sexual purity. He denies lusting after women there in verse 1 through 4. He denies any form of adultery in verses 9 through 12. He claims that he is a man of honesty and justice. He denies any kind of deceit or fraud or mistreating even his employees. He speaks of his manservant or his maidservant. There can be no accusation against him of him treating these people that served him, treating them unfairly in any way. He was characterized by honesty and justice. We see this in verses 5 through 8 and again in verses 13 to 15. He exercised a type of social responsibility, and he denies ever neglecting the poor. We already saw his own testimony of that. He didn't neglect those that were vulnerable, widows or orphans or any of them. And if that's the case, let the judgment fall, he says. There's no accusation that could be leveled against him of idolatry. You see this in verses 24 to 28. He also denies trusting in his own wealth in that section, or worshiping the sun and the moon, bowing down in some form of idolatry. He denies rejoicing in enemies' misfortune or concealing his own sins. He even denies misusing or exploiting his own land in an unjust way in verses 38 to 40. This is him providing this negative confession, saying, if any of these things would be true of me, I would deserve this form of justice and this form of judgment. But I'm claiming and I'm declaring my innocence. What we're going to find when we move into the next section, is we're going to find this continued push for a form of retributive justice that no one seems to be able to get away from. Even Job himself is still claiming this form of conviction. And yet we see in the midst of this man who is indeed upright and faithful and just before God. That is the declaration of God himself. And when we see these kinds of things from Job, I know that it might be a struggle for us to kind of put it into a New Testament, New Covenant context. It seems as though Job is trying to sort of justify himself. He's trying to sort of claim that there's no sin in him at all, that somehow he can come before a holy God in full cleansed perfection. And that's really not what we're seeing here. What we're seeing is the actual testimony of a man who is crying out to God for his justice to prevail. We've seen this over and over again. But we're also seeing him cry out in true anguish, as we've seen over and over again as well. I alluded to the Psalm 23, the passage that we all know so well about the faithfulness of the Good Shepherd. This Psalm of David, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters. He restores my soul. He leads me in paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. You prepare a table for me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil. My cup overflows. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I shall dwell in the house of the Lord forever. And we see that, and we see David, the apple of God's eye, and the one in whose line would come the Messiah and the Savior. And we see all this, and we're like, isn't this a pleasant psalm? And isn't this the posture of a true man of God? But all we have to do is turn back to the previous chapter, and we see David saying this, my God, why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far from saving me from the words of my groanings? Oh my God, I cry by day, but you do not answer. By night, I find no rest, yet you are holy, enthroned on the praises of Israel. This is a picture of the travails of every person who is fighting for faithfulness in the midst of the most profound seasons of suffering. And the key for us is to fight for trust and confidence in the Lord. And when he seems distant and far, we call out to him and ask him to return, even though he is not far from any of us ever. And we fight like Job, and we maintain our integrity. We don't allow ourselves to become weakened and to the extent that we begin to walk in deceit, or we give ourselves a pass of not walking in holiness and godliness and not walking in the Spirit and representing Christ well because we're going through a season of trial. No, we maintain our integrity. We walk in faithfulness and uprightness even as we suffer, and we cry out for God's mercy and justice. Let's pray.